This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to our first market talk of 2026. The opening weeks of this year have given investors a rude awakening from the festive holidays, with geopolitics remaining front and centre. My name's Harry Brooks. I'm a content manager at L&G, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy Asia. Happy New Year, Ben. I think it's fine to keep saying that until we reach Chinese New Year.
Well, that's a bit of a movable target, though, isn't it? Because this time around, the Chinese New Year is in the middle of February. So are we going to carry on doing that for the next few weeks? But anyway, yeah, Happy New Year to you as well. We'll give you one last go.
It gives me plenty of time to give belated Happy New Years to everyone. So look, there's loads to talk about. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, which marks the first anniversary of President Trump's second term as US president. Trade tariffs have, of course, been one of the hallmarks of his two administrations. And over the weekend, the president raised the possibility of tariffs against several European countries if they oppose his plans for Greenland. I'm very aware that this is a fluid situation and events may move on between us recording this episode and it being released on Thursday. But nonetheless, I'm interested in the market's initial reaction to this news. What have we seen?
Well, I think that's right. The headlines are quite aggressive, aren't they? It's talking about 10% tariffs at the end of February, or the beginning of February, I think it is, isn't it? Then 25% potentially later, as eight countries have been highlighted. And as you say, President Trump is going to Davos this week, isn't he? So I think there's going to be lots of developments, very fluid, as you mentioned. The interesting thing from a market perspective, the initial reaction, the interesting thing is it's relatively small. I mean, yeah, today we can see S&P futures, NASDAQ futures are down a bit. Yesterday, Monday, as we're taping on Tuesday, as you say, the Monday was a holiday in the US, so I guess we're getting a full weekend plus the Monday. That reaction is going to be bottled into today's reaction. But as it looks right now, it's relatively minor, certainly relatively minor compared to those initial Liberation Day knee-jerk reactions this time last year, or just a little under a year ago. We have seen modest falls in the dollar. And like I said, small corrections in equities, some increase in yields. There's other stuff going on there, which I'm sure we'll talk about. I think investors are programmed not to overreact because we've seen a lot of these big headlines. We've seen a lot of these potential tariffs that have ultimately come down to something more modest over time. And if you've reacted too aggressively, you've found that you're out of pocket. So I think that's why we've seen a relatively modest reaction. Now, we have seen a couple of more aggressive moves within sectors. So, you know, European autos, for example, had a bit of a bad day yesterday. I guess they would be very impacted if you were to see big tariffs. So even if it's a small chance of happening, it could have a big reaction. It's been better for defense companies in Europe, though, which have done well. So, but beyond those specific sectors, relatively minor reactions.
Interesting, as you say, that gap between the drama, of course, that we see in the headlines and the actual impact on markets. Thinking back to last year, obviously, we saw several episodes of real geopolitical uncertainty leading to volatility, or perhaps in some cases, perceptions of volatility. Do you think there are any time-honoured ideas that are worth kind of keeping in mind during episodes like this?
Absolutely. And I mentioned earlier about not overreacting, because potentially some of these issues get watered down over time. But I think that's not just the case today with President Trump. I think that's a reasonable thing to think about over a longer period of time. We have a mantra within the asset allocation team of prepare, don't predict, which sounds a bit passive, doesn't it? Don't predict anything, just prepare. But actually, we're actively pushing against investors' biases of overreaction, which sometimes happens. There's a great blog actually on the Legal & General blog site, which goes into this into a little bit more detail, talking about some of these biases, overreaction, overconfidence. They set out 10 things to do with these geopolitical issues. And to be honest, when I think about geopolitics, it's really something that I don't want to put a huge amount of positioning on any one outcome, because it is so hard to forecast. I mean, did anyone forecast at the beginning of Trump's presidency what would happen last year? I don't think so. So if you can't forecast it, don't try and position for it. But yeah, have a look at that blog. It's really quite useful to try and think about the best way of approaching these situations.
So US foreign policy is obviously claiming the lion's share of headlines at the moment, but developments within the US are also cracking on as always. Last week, for instance, CPI inflation data, I think, came in at a steady level of 2.7%, I think the same as the previous month. The commentary that I read basically took this as evidence that the tariffs that have been put in place already haven't had the big impact on inflation that some people had worried we might see. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, the caveat to all this data that we're still getting now is that it's relatively old data because of the government shutdown last year sort of messed all the timings up. It's also messing a little bit of the data collection, and it's also messing a little bit of the economics. I mean, some people weren't paid for a period of time, so they're going to have maybe put off spending, and then they're doing some catch-up spending. So that's all going on. But even within that caveat, I think it's accurate to say there's little evidence of surging inflation. So we're not seeing that coming through. But at the same time, there's also, we've had some unemployment data. And there was a concern, wasn't there, at the end of last year, maybe a little bit earlier than that, that we were getting a weak US employment period. Maybe the job market was softening. And we got that rate cut by the Federal Reserve at the end of last year, almost as an insurance rate cut, wasn't it? Just in case the employment sector was going to deteriorate rapidly. But again, we've had better employment data. I guess that sort of benign backdrop for inflation, benign backdrop for employment, reasonably good growth, all that sort of stuff. The markets are factoring in maybe 50 basis points more cuts this year by the Federal Reserve. So maybe two times 25 basis point cuts. That's being pushed back into the second half of this year. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the next 6 months. So that might not even happen at all, depending on what happens. So it feels as though we're in a sort of steady as she goes. I think that's what that's how you describe the CPI, steady, benign backdrop, reasonably good for risk assets in all fairness. And maybe that's another reason why markets have reacted relatively, positively, well, I guess not that negatively to all the geopolitical headlines that we've got, this sort of holding in because the macro backdrop's pretty strong.
Okay, sticking with the theme of risk assets, earnings season, of course, is getting going in the US now. We've talked before about the sort of performative, if you like, aspect of earnings season where expectations can be set at a level that aims to allow them to be beaten. But I'm interested nonetheless in, have there been any surprises so far this year, or perhaps themes that are starting to emerge from the information that we've got?
Earnings season has been, throughout the last few years, really a sort of beacon of positivity because companies still making lots of money. This time around, the S&P 500 will probably pass another 10% increase in earnings compared to this time last year. So then, you know, earnings are going up more than 10% on a year-on-year basis. You break that down, though. You ask about some sort of patterns. You break it down, and really the big technology companies are making a lot of money. So the big six technology stocks, maybe you can try and think which ones I'm talking about. But let's say the big six technology stocks, they're expected to increase earnings by 20%+. So that's, you know, really beating the average. The rest are going to be more like 5%. Still not bad, but, you know, it's really those big AI companies. And those big AI companies are almost the size of asset classes themselves. So earnings are interesting, useful, but it's really going to be these handful of earnings from these AI companies that we're all focused on. The other quite interesting development last week, at the beginning of the earnings season, you always get the big banks, the big US banks announcing their results. This time around, those banks saw negative reaction generally to their share price. The S&P Financials Index was down last week. And part of that was due to some more rhetoric from President Trump talking about things like capping interest rates for credit cards, which hasn't gone down very well with the bank equities because, you know, that potentially they could make less money. So earnings this time around has been a little bit of an unusual start, but I would expect it to be generally a positive, a tailwind in association with that relatively benign, positive macro backdrop. Again, a support for asset classes.
Got it. So some caveats, but broadly a positive direction of travel at the moment, it seems. Taking a step back from the US focus, we're obviously not very far into 2026 yet, but I can't help but notice that Asian equity markets seem to be off to a really strong start. I wonder if, given the focus on geopolitical risk that's swirling around markets in the West, do you feel like this is affecting interest in Asia for overseas investors as a long-term strategic allocation?
Yes, I mean, the Hang Seng here in Hong Kong is up sort of 4% or so. This is close of Monday, the 19th of January. I'm talking about these numbers. So that was up 4%. Topix in Japan up 7%. Again, something going on in Japan. Again, we might talk about that later. But yeah, strong. And I do believe, I mean, it's, you can't extrapolate whatever 2-3 weeks worth of data, and you can't put it to any particular trend, but people are definitely looking at their US exposure. And if they believe that they are overly exposed to the US for whatever reason, they want to have diversification. I think that's a reason why they're having a look at other markets. And that will be potentially a support through the whole of this year. US equity markets, particularly if you denominated in foreign currencies, didn't have a great year last year. They lagged a lot of indices, partly because the dollar was weaker, right? And the US equities, of course, denominated in dollars. And maybe that continues for another year. That was very, very different to people's expectations. When President Trump was elected, we all thought there was going to be another multi-year of US exceptionism. That does seem to have been eroded. So we're seeing that in equity markets. We're also seeing it in credit markets. A lot of people are getting more interested in things like emerging market credit, euro-denominated credit. So that diversification theme is playing out at the start of this year, and I think that will continue.
Within Asia, one market that's done really particularly well is South Korea, with the KOSPI index that tracks the biggest companies in that country up something like 15% in the year to date, I think, and virtually doubling over the past 12 months. What's been going on there?
I think the most important thing before you get into the fundamentals is that little over 12 months ago, it was the question mark. Everyone was looking at Korea, South Korea, and the equity markets having underperformed everything else and going, look, there's something wrong with South Korea. You know, maybe the politics is difficult, the corporate governance is difficult. People were trying to blame things, and lots of people were uninvested. And then lo and behold, run it forward 12 months, and as you say, it's doubled. And I think partly that's because people were uninvested and having to now catch up and trying to buy stuff. It has been benefiting from the AI trend as well, but you know, that was also the case when it was underperforming a little while ago. It's having the trade element is very strong in South Korea as well, so selling all these AI related technology stocks. So there is a fundamental reason for it, but I suspect a lot of it, as I said, is that technicals. And looking ahead, if you try and think, okay, what's going to be the next asset class that's currently unloved and will do really well in the next 12 months? I mean, you tell me, what are people really don't like at the minute? Maybe Chinese real estate. It's hard to like that, isn't it? But you know, that maybe has a positive, just general sort of commercial office space that's had a tough period. Maybe that's going to be the asset class to go forward. But yeah, trying to find something that everyone hates and then trying to like it yourself, that's a tough job.
Trying to find a frog to kiss, yeah.
Yes.
You mentioned Japan a minute ago, and you shared earlier in the week an interesting chart that showed the really quite big and sustained rise in the yield on the 30-year Japanese government bond over the past 12 months or so. What's been driving that rise, and what's our view on whether it will continue? And how does this fit in with what's been happening politically in the country?
Look, I think this is super, super, super important, actually. So Japanese yields, as we've known for multiple decades, were virtually at 0% and were a little bit of an anchor on global yields. In effect, if you're a Japanese investor, you could choose to buy 0% yielding domestic bonds, or you could then go out into the world and buy more attractive European government bonds, treasuries, credit markets, whatever it might be. And I think that flow of funds out of Japan was helping keep yields suppressed everywhere else. But as you say, things have turned. First turn has been that Japan is starting to get some inflation, not rampant, but it's starting to see inflation move from that the lost multi-decades deflationary trend. It's now starting to get inflation, and they are also, like everyone else, starting to see the fiscal easy fiscal light, I suppose. You know, post COVID, all governments have decided it's a really good thing to spend loads of money and have a big deficit. And there's a new prime minister in Japan, Takaichi. She has just called a new an election because she wants to get a bigger majority. We'll see if she gets it. I think the election's 8th of February, so we don't have to wait very long. If she gets a big majority, she could double down on those deficits. And I think that combination of inflation escaping the deflation zone, plus the prospect of even higher deficits, is leading to these higher yields. I think the move is so significant. I think a lot is in the price now. What else are we going to find out that's going to drive yields even higher? I mean, famous last words, volatility is pretty huge right now. But a lot is in the price. 30-year Japanese government bond yields today have gone up 25 basis points. They're near 4% now. Those 30-year JGBs, Japanese government bond yields, the price of that bond dropped 3% today. Again, these are big moves. So opposing that is a difficult thing because the volatility is so high. But you know, if you can have a little bit, if you can size the positions correctly, and you can take the volatility, those sorts of high yields, some investors are going to find that attractive at these points. And maybe I would even ask whether the issuing authorities in Japan, so the people, you know, the Ministry of Finance, maybe they would like to not lock in those high yields at 30s. Maybe they'll prefer to issue shorter data bonds. And if they start issuing less longer data bonds, again, that might support longer data bonds. So yeah, very volatile. Yields have moved. It might be an opportunity over the long term, but you've got to be careful with this size of volatility.
On the theme of government bonds and the yields on them, the 10-year UK gilt yield has been heading in the opposite direction from Japan's government bonds since, I think, around October. And I can see, looking at the figures for inflation for the UK, that it's also fallen over that same sort of period, which I guess kind of, you know, paves the way for potential interest rate cuts. Does that explain what we've seen, or are there other factors at play here?
Yeah, so again, I think this is the theme of this podcast, isn't it? There's a little bit of fundamental justification and there's the technicals going on. So I agree there has been some fundamental improvements in the story in the UK. So we have seen inflation gradually come down. We've got some more inflation data this week. Today we got some employment data, which has been a bit softer. Again, that would argue potentially for maybe a rate cut or two this year, and that helps keep bond yields a little bit lower. But I also think that there's technicals. You know, there are periods in time quite often, and for some justification, where international investors, even UK domestic investors, are a bit worried about UK Inc. And there's some risk premium in those bond yields based on political risk, whatever it might be. And we had a budget, didn't we, round about the same time as you were talking about that October. I think the budget was in November, which surprised positively in terms of trying to keep the fiscal deficit under check. And look, the place where I generally like to own government bonds is when the government is also motivated to try and keep yields low. And that's not always the case in the UK. That's not always the case in Japan. But, you know, when you can feel that the government is hoping to keep yields down, that's when you can feel a bit more comfortable investing. And that has been the case over the last few months. Now, yields have fallen to such a degree that maybe there's not risk premium there. There certainly isn't as much risk premium as before. So it's a bit less attractive right now, I think, to be going long UK bonds compared to what it was a few months ago. But yeah, that might change again in the next few weeks and months. So keep an eye on that.
We've reached the familiar point in the podcast once again, where I ask you, Ben, for your number of the week for us.
Well, the eagle-eared, is that eagle-eyed, eagle-eared listeners might realise, might question why I haven't mentioned gold so far this episode, because it has been the talk of everyone. So my number of the week, 78%. That's the return of gold since the beginning of last year. 78%, and it's up a chunk again this year. And the argument for gold is there's lots of ways of describing saying why gold has gone up in price. I will again say some of it's fundamental, some of it's technical. Fundamentally, lots of central banks want to own gold because they've seen the US weaponized treasuries, and we've definitely seen some purchasing of that. I think maybe corporate investors, even household investors, are buying it as a geopolitical risk premium. But I wouldn't go too much on that, because as I've mentioned right at the beginning, there isn't an awful lot of risk premium anywhere else. So why is all the risk premium for geopolitics going into gold? So I think there's got to be some speculation here. There's got to be people buying. I saw today in the newspaper here in Hong Kong, there are pictures of people lining up to sell their gold at the local brokers. So there's obviously a price where people think this is crazy, the amount of the price that is at, and some people will start to sell at this level as well, won't they? So anyway, it's had an amazing run. It won't go up and up and up forever, but right now it is super strong, and that's definitely been the asset class to own, that and the KOSPI, I guess, over the last 12 months.
Thanks so much for your time, Ben. Look forward to catching up with you again in February next month. And thanks to all our listeners as well.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.